Hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and the show that you are listening to is Final Draft. It is your weekly dose of books, writing, and literary culture. As we get started, I want to acknowledge that 2SER is broadcasting from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Now, I am at home. I am recording from lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people up in the mountains. I want to pay my respects to the traditional owners, their ongoing connection to their lands, and also acknowledge that it is stolen land, that there are issues that still need to be resolved there. Treaty was never reached. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, last week on the show, we featured a conversation with Jane McCready from Writing New South Wales. We were talking about the funding cut that will come into effect at the end of the year. Writing New South Wales will be losing its state government funding, which is the bedrock of their program throughout the years. So it's created an existential crisis for Writing New South Wales. And at the moment, there are no updates on that story. The Writing New South Wales is still waiting for a response from the Arts Minister. They are still waiting to hear from Don Harwin to find out if there is going to be any sort of way that they can discuss or move forward with this funding crisis. I guess in more happy news, despite COVID shutting so much of what we do down, the online world has kind of picked it up, and we are still getting things like literary festivals happening. And in fact, the Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival is going ahead this year on the 10th till the 13th of September. Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival is going online. You can join them and featuring such amazing crime writers as Anne Cleves, Joe Nesbo, Don Wilson, Karen Slaughter. You can go to badsydney.com and check out their program. They have got tickets on sale, and it is so heartening. I don't know about anyone else, but I have been tuning into Zoom book launches and getting involved with, I guess, that online kind of networking. It's not quite the socials. It's about still being involved in the book writing world, the literary world that we love so much. And it keeps moving forward. I have got a great book for you today, but I also just want to note that there are also amazing shortlists. The Ned Kelly Awards are coming up. The Reddings shortlist for New Australian Fiction has come out. So if you want to keep abreast of these things, you can follow Final Draft on Twitter, on Facebook, on all the socials. On all the socials, if it's a new social, we're probably not on it, but we're definitely on the big ones. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. Now, today on the show, I have got a new novel from Jock Sarong. He is the winner of the Colin Roderick Award. He's won a Ned Kelly Award. I mentioned their shortlist before. And his latest is The Burning Island. It does follow on from his previous novel, Preservation, and creates just this incredible adventurous romp. It is an adventure on the seas. It is a historical novel, and Jock is a fantastic person to talk to. So stick around, discover The Burning Island, the latest from Jock Sarong. It's all coming up on Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel, and it's after this very short break.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and I've got such a great book to share with you right now, and an absolutely fantastic author on the line. Jock Sarong is the author of 5 novels, including The Rules of Backyard Cricket and the Colin Roderick Award-winning On the Java Ridge. It's been almost 2 years since Jock and I spoke about Preservation, his historical exploration of the wreck of the Sydney Cove in 1797. Jock's returning to that milieu with his new book and hitting the water again for his latest novel, The Burning Island. Jock, welcome back. Thank you for joining me on the show.
G'day, Andrew. I can't believe it's been 2 years. That's a shock.
Let's go back in time. Let's go to some familiar waters. In the township of Sydney, Eliza Grayling, she's something of an oddity. She's too tall, too old, too sure of herself without a man. for marriage. She teaches unappreciative children and wonders what the world might have in store for a woman such as her. Now, when the merchant Srinivas appears in search of her father, Eliza is thrown into a world of old enmities and new perils. She has to guide her now blind father aboard the ship Moonbird with its ragtag crew of misfits. Eliza embarks on a journey to discover and perhaps settle score with the mysterious figure of Mr. Fig. I really hope I did justice to the drama and to the setup of The Burning Island, because there is just so much scope, and it's such a large book and so dramatic. I was hooked from the beginning.
Yeah, I think you did, Andrew. It's funny, I struggle to encapsulate the novel in just a few words. There's a lot of elements spinning off in different directions, and I think what you've said there really captures it. It's just an adventure at sea, but it's also something of a hymn to Bass Strait and to those islands, and it's a study of those times. 1830 is a really interesting little hinge in Australian history, because the missionary George Augustus Robinson was trying to clear Aboriginal people out of Tasmania, and indeed out of the islands, to put them in a settlement. And there was a community of sealers down there who were pretty much hiding from him. There was a lot going on in historical terms. So it kind of operates at a few different levels.
And I guess perspective is so important to what you're saying there, because those communities, those sealers, there is our perspective, are set up in the novel that they are perhaps lawless, perhaps in some way even villains of the piece. But we really have to consider, you know, who are we taking our information from?
That's exactly right. Robinson was an obsessive diarist, and he wrote tens of thousands of words about his efforts to round up the Tasmanian Aborigines. And a lot of what we have as history about the sealers in those islands came from Robinson's diaries. And Robinson had an agenda. You know, he was a very, very capable propagandist. So the history as we know it really is pretty contentious, and you can find multiple versions of it. None of these things are clearly settled, and yet we don't talk about them very much.
The Burning Island takes as its departure point the characters from Preservation. However, the journey of the Moonbird is a fiction. Was it more freeing to work within the history this way, with a complete sort of fictional journey, and how are you then still bound to the times and the places that you depict?
It is freeing at times, but the advantage of writing fairly directly from history is that you've got a template laid out for you. In other words, I knew how many people needed to survive this part and that part, and where they would be at a given point in the journey and what they were carrying. All those things were laid down for me. When you're making the story up, you are both at liberty, but you're also a little at sea, because you're trying to ensure that the story has an internal cohesion, that it's got enough momentum, that it does the things it needs to do to keep the reader on the page. I think with Burning Island, I wanted to address some truths. I wanted to talk about the sealers and their wives. I wanted to talk about the warrior Taranora. And I wanted to talk about what Robinson was doing to the place and to the people at that time. So those are historical realities that I wanted to make sure were in there. But I also wanted to follow an imaginative path that's more like Heart of Darkness. It's a journey into the devil's lair. And the key to a Heart of Darkness approach is that the people on the quest aren't going to find what they're looking for. They're going to find something else entirely. So that was the guiding principle, I think, in putting the plot together.
Mm. We spend so much of the journey on the Moonbird. And in my opening, I described the Moonbird, its crew, its passengers as a ragtag band of misfits. And that's a bit of a cliche. That's usually sort of evokes the trope, you know, they're not the best, but they're the best for the job. I honestly found myself drawing parallels with, you know, cinematic images of things like Star Wars, Rogue One, or the Guardians of the Galaxy. Can you talk to me about assembling this such a disparate group?
Yeah, I like it as a description that they're a ragtag crew. when I started out, I suppose, I knew I wanted Eliza and her father to be on the boat. I knew I needed a skipper because it wasn't going to be either of them. And then I thought, okay, I need crew, and then I need a mysterious outsider. So I had these, I suppose, fundamental elements that I needed mechanically for the boat to work. But it's only a fair way into the writing process that you start to see that combination of characters as a crew and as a community. And once I'd settled into that as an idea, it's really very helpful to the writing because they're stuck within the confines of a small boat and they're all bouncing off each other all the time. So in any given scene, I can think about, okay, who's talking? What are they doing? And where's everyone else? And once you think about, okay, where's everyone else, then little sparks of plot start to strike off that. Somebody else might be drinking, or they might be in the rigging, or they might be up to no good, or they might be asleep. And before long, you can really get momentum out of the interactions between those characters. Once you're comfortable with who they are and what's driving them, then the transactional stuff starts to happen, and that makes the telling of the story easier and also hopefully a bit richer.
Yeah, the wonder of the characters I found is so much in very passive interactions, perhaps not something that directly drives the story. I mean, the visual of and something I'm going to leave as maybe a little bit of a surprise for people to discover, but the visual of the captain each day or the interaction of the Connolly brothers. But look, for me, Eliza is the true wonder of the novel. She is precisely the sort of person you would want to know. But because this is not now, but the 19th century, she occupies this sort of liminal zone. She's an outsider, but she also has the perspective and intelligence to observe and to serve as our sort of narratorial perspective. There is a sense, though, in which all the characters are battling with a kind of personal imprisonment or an outsider status. Grayling, Joshua Grayling has his fall from grace. Argyle has this inability to express his true self. The Connolly brothers, they're thrown together against their troubled youths and sort of have come together for protection and friendship. This is an era when difference was toxic and you really couldn't fall too far outside of societal norms. Did it give you scope within the boat to explore these personalities perhaps as we might understand them today?
Yes, and you have to always be on guard if you're writing historical fiction not to impose current values on these people. Mm. For instance, Eliza's horror and despair at being a spinster at 32 years of age sounds comically underdone as a modern concept. But in that time and place, it would have been a very serious life issue. And when she's on the boat and on the journey, my way of thinking of this is that Eliza is looking for allies. She's got an enormous task on her hands looking after her father on that boat. And she's looking among the other people on the boat for solidarity and for guidance at times. She's a very capable woman, but equally she has her hands full getting through this. And so she turns to each of them, you know, one by one to be her allies. And they've all got their own difficulties to grapple with. And that's why when the boat finally reaches the islands and events start to spiral on the islands, they band together in various ways because they've been through this journey together already. I think of the islands as a completely separate part of the story to what went on the boat on the way down there.
Eliza, at one point, she describes the islands they're sailing towards as an antipode to our antipode, a place where bad men went to hide. To what extent did you want to explore the makeup of these settler colonials who had then gone on to occupy the extremes of that world at the time?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that we use the colloquial expression, the antipodes, to describe ourselves, or Europeans might use it to describe Australia. But the idea of an antipode as a concept is really a rich one, and I think the islands are the far-flung inverse, the negative image of the continent itself. And I came across this odd thing when I was researching that there was a belief around this time in history that each major landform on the planet had an exact reverse on the opposite side of the planet. And Dr. Gideon talks about this at one stage in respect of, I think, Redondo Island, that it was named because on the precise point on the globe that is its opposite, there is exactly the same landform. And that was what got me going on the idea of an antipode to an antipode. And a similar concept is Dr. Gideon talking about the moon being having been projected or released from the Pacific Ocean, and that the Pacific Ocean is the moon's void on Earth, and that that is the linguistic reason why shearwaters are called moonbirds, because they sail they fly a migratory path around the rim of the Pacific. So all of these, you know, old and deep geographical ideas that were very prevalent in the 19th century, they have lovely philosophical and psychological undertones that you can really riff on in literature, and there's an endless number of them. I think I probably plucked a couple that really appealed to me, but it's a fascinating field.
What was it like exploring the science of the world that you were creating, but then also keeping it within the science of the time? Because, of course, you've talked about the doctor there, and he is very much involved in investigation. But, of course, you're bound by the 1830s and the current knowledge.
Yes. I've always been very interested in a wave of naturalists who were responsible for naming a lot of marine species. There was Linnaeus, there was obviously Humboldt, there was Cuvier, and these people were not hard scientists as we might think of the notion, but they were swashbuckling adventurers, they were speculators, they were very often on the make, and they were promoting their own brand by naming things. And I wanted to give Dr. Gideon a bit of an element of that, that yes, he has an intellectual curiosity about the creatures, things like paper nautiluses and deep sea fish, but equally he wants it to be about him. He wants to be the person who dissected it, who found the secrets of some strange invertebrate. So where medicine was moving more into a hard-nosed scientific realm, natural sciences like biology of this kind were still very much the domain of these adventurers. So I wanted Dr. Gideon to really reflect that, I suppose.
You also play really nicely with the overlap, what we might think of as the overlap between science and philosophy and I guess a certain religiosity at the time. And there's a trope that you use. I'm just gonna tread really carefully around spoilers here, but where Dr. Gideon is very interested in the Fibonacci sequence, but particularly as a sort of descending sequence, a looping spiral that will move ever onwards into an infinite point. That's an absolutely fascinating way to structure, I guess, an idea, a philosophy, but also to build some part of narrative around, isn't it?
Yes, and often they're things that start as idle curiosities. They're little things that you trip over researching something else that's much more practical. And they become the stone in your shoe, and the more you think about them, the more you realise that they have inner meanings. And the inverse of the Fibonacci sequence, the idea of a closing spiral. I think it's actually Eliza Grayling who suddenly twigs, and it really disconcerts her, that if the shape of the voyage that the moonbird is making from Sydney down into Bass Strait and then ever tighter into the islands is actually forming a spiral, then the spiral is going to close in on itself. And she sort of desperately asks him at one point, well, how are we going to get home? And I love that as an idea. She sort of tries to make a joke of it and talks about it forming a Bass Clef, and then that leads her into Bass Strait. But Dr. Gideon has, if you remember Willy Wonka in, I think it's in the film and not in the book of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, he does a rather terrifying riff on the rowers on the Chocolate River and the fact that they don't know where they're going and they just keep on rowing.
We're, of course, talking about Gene Wilder. The Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Dr. Gideon, I think, has a similar idea of the voyage into Bass Strait, that there's an element of chaos and unpredictability about what they're doing, even though they've drawn themselves a line on the map where they want to go. It's this closing spiral that that completely terrifies Eliza.
And for anyone who hasn't seen it, I mean, that's definitely worth just getting on YouTube and looking up that sequence from the original film, because it has no place in a children's film. It's terrifying, that sequence. And Gene Wilder plays it to terrifying effect, as it just goes on and on, and the monotone in his voice. It really would not be out of place, I think, perhaps in moments in The Burning Island, because, look, there is something epic in the setup of The Burning Island. And you've talked there about Eliza and her searching for allies, her suspicion. I think on at least one occasion, if not several, she looks at one of the members of the Moonbird and thinks she wants to trust them in a way that she can't even trust herself. So you've got us constantly off balance. But really, the epic setup, you have the crippled hero in the blind and fallen from grace, Joshua Grayling, or we're meant to put our hopes on him as being the hero, pitted against the larger-than-life villainy of Fig. And their stories are revealed in the tellings of their past. I mean, the figure of Fig is mythic. He exists sort of almost outside the story, although we do know them both from Preservation. I'm intrigued by both of them, but particularly in that hidden and shadowy figure of the villain. Do you feel, sort of, especially from a narrative perspective, that the villainy works best off stage in a way that allows the threat to grow in the minds of the other characters?
Well, I think that was very much the idea, Andrew, and you're right on the money there. What I think it does is that people with their ordinary fallibilities are able to project their fears onto something that's offstage. So for all of us as Australians, if you go back 10 years, we projected a lot of our insecurities as a nation onto terrorists as a vague and amorphous concept. We projected our insecurities onto asylum seekers. And in this very specific instance, you're looking at people. To take Joshua Grayling, he's blind and he's an alcoholic and his best days are behind him, and he thinks, and his daughter thinks, that he's really on a decline to the end of his life. But there's this mythic villain out there, and he has one last shot at finding and stopping this man. And it means that he can push aside everything else that's gone wrong and somehow redeem himself by attacking this other thing. And Eliza can see that, and she keeps reminding him, how about we deal with the practical here? You want to make a boat journey and take on a very, very capable adversary, and you can't see, and you're an addict. How is this all going to work? But it's equally true of her that she has had a very, very regulated, cloistered life in Sydney as a governess to a rich family. And she has a romantic idea of the sea and the islands, and she thinks that could be the other her, that could be this entire other existence. And it's no clearer that that's very realistic either. The same is true of each of the people on the boat, that they're trying to project themselves towards something else that they can't quite define, but at least it stops them obsessing about the miserable present. And I think that idea works in lots of larger and smaller ways.
So do they find the villain? Well, I'm going to leave it up to everyone to go and read The Burning Island. We're not telling anyone, Jock. Please go. I'm speaking with Jock Sarong. His latest novel is The Burning Island, and it is an incredible historical novel. It is an incredible adventure romp. It is a sea journey. It is so many things. Jock, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing these insights.
Oh, Andrew, it's a great pleasure. It's really nice to talk to you.
Stories, ideas, music, 2SER. 107.3.
Yes, you are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture. Now, my name is Andrew Popel. I want to say thank you again to Jock Sarong. Jock is absolutely fantastic to have on the show. And today we were discussing his latest novel, The Burning Island. As may have come out in my conversation with Jock, this has historical elements that are well worth exploring, but it is also just a really fun book. It is an adventure on the high seas. It has mystery, and I really loved exploring it. So thank you again to Jock. Now, if you want to catch more of that conversation, if you want to hear more from Jock, you can go to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast, wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're available up on Apple, but all the podcatchers. And while you're there, there are more than 100 conversations available with Australian authors on the podcast. And if you are enjoying them, give us a rating. Leave a comment. I would love to hear from you about what you're reading, what you're enjoying. It is so important, especially now that we share Australian writing with the world and help Australian writers, you know, get their work out there. If you're enjoying it, then go to the podcast and enjoy it some more and leave us a rating. I'm going to leave us with a track, but look, I just also want to remind you, even though we are stuck inside quite a lot more than we're used to, there is so much going on in the online world. The Bad Crime Writers Festival is coming up, and you can find out more. Just go to badsydney.com and you can check out so much of what's going on in the literary world, literary shortlists, news. We want to cover it all on Final Draft. Now, I am going to leave you with a track. This is from Leah Flanagan, Support Australian Music. She is Sydney-based from Darwin. Leah Flanagan, this new song from her is called Linen Girls. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week. Bye now.
How often does it cross your mind? Linen girls all dressed in white, drinking in afternoon light, while all you know's another life. Tell me, does it cross your mind? Supposed to